We're holding at the bottom of page 10 in Yuma, paragraph Shum Tanurabanan, middle of Os Yud Aleph. We started talking yesterday about the Kohen Gadol, the day before Yom Kippur and the night before Yom Kippur. They were careful, well, the day before Yom Kippur, they were careful what he eats, so he doesn't end up, first of all, he just shouldn't eat too much of any food so he doesn't fall asleep, and second of all, he shouldn't eat certain foods because those are likely to cause him to become tummy with Kerem. So we meant the last thing we learned yesterday is in a similar vein, a zav, there are certain foods that are also overeating in general, or certain foods in particular, can precipitate zivus, and that's relevant as far as, first of all, to finding out whether his second emission made him a zav, because the second emission has to be completely idiopathic, as they call it in medical ease, without any known cause, for him to become tame, and also because during his seven clean days, if he has any emission of ziva, even if it's ba'onus, then it's going to cancel out all his 7 days. In fact, Tosafos Yeshayahu explains that's why here we're talking about that they would make sure of, there's a whole list of foods that they tell a zov not to eat. Why don't we find that they specifically would tell the Kohen Gadol not to eat those either? And so Tosafos Yeshayahu says, because it's not like it's that likely that these particular herbs and things that the Gemara is going to quote now are going to bring to Keri. There's a slight possibility of it. So therefore, by the Kohen Gadol, they're not so worried about it. But by the Zov, it's not so much he's not allowed to, but as a matter of good advice, given that for him, any kind of ziva, even ba'onus, is going to cancel out his 7 days, then he would be well advised not to eat these things. So yesterday we learned there were certain things. We said there were milk, cheese, eggs, and wine, and split pea soup, fat meat, and fish juice. So now the Braisa had also mentioned other things that bring to Tuma. So now what are those other things? So now we pick up from there. Tana Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa. There are five kinds of foods besides the ones that we mentioned before that may make a person susceptible to Tuma. The Elohim, Hashum, garlic. In fact, we find the Gemara in Bava Kamma tells us that Ezra made a takana that people specifically should eat garlic on Friday night because it's Marbes HaZera and it increases production of Zera. And that way, since Friday night is the particular time for Oina between husband and wife, then therefore that helps with that. So anyway, so garlic, Vashachalayim, and cress, which is a type of herb with a sharp flavor. We find it mentioned in many places in Shas. We had about it in Psachim, that if a person at the end of Psachim, in the whole part over there about Shadim, that if a person eats it and doesn't wash his hands afterwards, then he's going to have a fear. He's going to have a nameless fear for a couple of days. Anyway, it's a plant mentioned throughout Shas. Vachluglugos is another kind of plant. In English, it's called purslane. It's also a plant. I don't know if people eat it nowadays, but you can, in those times, they would eat it in salads and whatnot. It's called rocket. It's also called arugula. You'll find it in the stores under that name. Anyway, so that's gargir. Vahabetzim and eggs. So all of those things make a man susceptible to having an emission of zera, and therefore again a zov should be careful not to eat those. Arugula, it's called. The older name for it is rocket, and you can find it in dictionaries under that name. But it's also known as arugula. And if you go into any greengrocers, you'll find they sell it. Yeah. Okay.
What's the story with split peas? It also causes problems.
We said yesterday. We mentioned that made gris and shalpul split pea soup. Yeah. Okay, so now the Gemara digresses to talk a little bit about the properties of this plant, gargir, or arugula. First of all, introducing with a pasuk from Malachim. The Psukim are telling us over there, there was a famine going on in Eretz Yisrael. Elisha, the Navi, has a yeshiva full of Talmidim, and he has to feed them. So he tells the cook to put up a pot of soup, and all the Talmidim went out to go and find herbs and things to put in the soup. So the pasuk says, "By Yetsa Echad al Asad al Laket Oros." One of the Talmidim went out into the field to gather oros. The simple meaning of oros means vegetables. And the pasuk goes on to say, what happened was he picked a certain kind of gourd, a certain kind of melon or something, which he didn't realize what the properties of it are, but he figured it's a vegetable, and he came and put it into the soup. And then they discovered it's poisonous. And then they tell Elisha, and Elisha tells them put some flour into the soup, and a mess happened, and the flour neutralized the poison. Anyway, what we're saying to begin with, this Talmud had gone out intending to collect oros. So what is oros? Tonimish Meir, Rav Meir is a gargir. So we learn in the name of Rav Meir, specifically he was going out to collect gargir. He was going out to collect arugula to put in the soup. And Amar Abyechan, Lama Nikol Shimon Oris. Why is that plant called Oris? Shema Iris Esay Nine, because it makes a person, it enlightens a person's eyes. Amar Rav Huna, in this connection, Rav Huna says, Hamotze Gargir, if a person finds a gargir, an arugula plant, im yochol oichloi oichloi, if he can eat it, then he should eat it, it's good for him. Vim lav, and if he's not able to eat it, let's say it doesn't belong to him, ma'viroi agabe enav, at least he should pass it over his eyes, and that itself will help his eyesight. Amar Rav Papa, gargira matzrena. Rav Papa says, specifically that refers to gargir that grows by the edge of a field. So you don't have anything else growing around it. So you don't have anything else competing with it for nutrients from the soil and sunlight and whatnot. So therefore, it grows very strong, as opposed to.
Still around nowadays.
So yeah, that's what I'm saying. You can go into the store. You can go into the store and ask for arugula, and they'll show it to you. Yeah. So but here, what you were saying, that particularly the one that grows by the edge of the field, where it's not competing with any other plants for nutrients, is particularly strong and particularly effective. Okay. So we've been talking about then this matter of keri, and again, the way we got into this is by saying that we're trying to take steps to avoid the Kohen Gadol becoming a Baal Keri on Yom Kippur. Marsha, by the way, refers to a Yerushalmi on this Mishnah that says what happened to, you know, we have in Pirkei Avos, the 10 Nisim that happened in the Bais Mikdash. The Gemara is going to discuss them at the end of this perek, and one of them is that the Kohen Gadol never had an emission of keri. And the answer is two answers, the Gemara says. One answer is, look, Lo Sinasu as Hashem Elokeichem, you're not allowed to test Hashem. You can't rely on Nisim. You have to take whatever steps you can, and Hashem will do the rest. So they have to take the steps, make sure the Kohen Gadol doesn't fall asleep, make sure he doesn't eat certain foods, etc., and then leave the rest up to Hashem. And a different answer that the Yerushalmi says is in the Bayis Rishon versus the Bayis Sheni, as we've been learning the last few days, the Kohenim of the first Bais Mikdash, the Kohenim Golem of the first Bais Mikdash were of a much higher caliber than the ones in the second. So in the first Bais Mikdash, they never had this problem. In the second Bais Mikdash, sometimes they did. Interestingly, Josephus tells in his histories about one, he tells about one particular example where Kohen Gadol became Tomei on Yom Kippur night and his Sagan had to take over. He mentions the name of that Sagan. The Gemara actually earlier in this parak mentions that story also, although without mentioning, it gives the name of that Sagan as well. Josephus has a funny expression when he tells it. He says this first Kohen Gadol had a dream that night that he had relations with his wife, which is a nice way of saying that he became a Baal Keri. So continuing on this topic of Keri, Omer of Gidol Omer Rab, Achsenoi lo yoichal beitzim. A person who's staying over as a guest by somebody's house should not eat eggs for the same reason, because we just said those are one of the foods that make them more susceptible to having keri, and therefore it's going to be a gnai. They may find stains of it on his sheets, and it would be embarrassing. Or Rabbi Hananel says even more so. Actually, what happens is the balabas might suspect that something's going on between this guest and his wife. Why else would there be zera on the bed? So the achsonoi should avoid that. V'loyishan b'talisa shal balabayis, and similarly, he should not sleep in the talis, meaning on the sheets or the blankets or whatever of the balabayis in particular. Rashi says that this is the sheet that you might use it as a bed sheet by night, and then the balabas uses it to wear by day. Same problem, there may be keri found on it. This, by the way, we have people are careful with that even now. You stay by somebody's house, then you bring along your own linens for the same reason. With that said, the general minhag is if you're paying for your lodgings, that's different. Then there's no gnai in it. So if you're staying in a hotel, or you're staying in a whatever, then you don't have to bring your own linens. Okay, more on this topic of avoiding keri and avoiding hirhur. The Gemara tells Rav ki mikol darshish, when Rav would visit the city of Darshish, where Rashi says he would visit there regularly, machriz, he would make an announcement, man havya l'yoma, who among the women over here is willing to be my wife for the one day, or not the one day, but in other words, the number as long as I'm going to be here, a temporary wife life. And similarly, Rav Nachman ki mikol l'shanziv, L'shchansiv machriz man habi l'yoma. And Rav Nachman would do the same thing when he visited the city of Shchansiv. Now, the Gemara is going to deal with the halachas of it now, how they're allowed to do that. But first, we have to ask, why on earth are they doing such a thing? They have wives at home. Surely they can control themselves for a little bit of time. So, I mean, balabatish, you could say, the Gemara is bringing this in over here to show even tzaddikim like that have a yetzer hara, and they still have to take steps to counteract it. In fact, Daf HaYomi of today discussed the very same point. The subject of today, most of the subject of today's Daf was the dinim of Yichud, and it actually at the end of Kiddushin, and it actually talks about the point that you have even great Talmid Chachamim who were very susceptible to Hurim. There's a couple of examples involving Rav Meir and Rav Akiva and other Chachamim where the Satan got involved and almost was machshel them in Aveiros. So in a simple sense, that's what's going on over here. With that said, there are a couple of other explanations. Ben Yehoyada says that the people in these places, in Darshish and Shchansiv, they took the view. So who says you have to get married at such a young age? You can wait till you're 30 or 40 or whatever, you'll get around to getting married then. They weren't worried about the fact that there was Hurim and all kinds of things like that. So therefore, Rav and Rav Nachman, each in their time, had to stress to them, no, you see that we, even though we're tzaddikim, even though we have wives at home, nevertheless, we understand how important it is to stay away from even the remotest chance of Hurim, and so it's not just, in other words, they wouldn't just make discreet inquiries, is there anybody who's willing to marry them? They would make a public announcement of it in order to stress to everybody in town how important it is to be married. That's how Ben Yehoyada says. Rav Reuven Margolius says a different part on it. He says, we find in a couple of places that the Persians at that time had a minhag of hospitality. The Persians were great at hospitality, but one of their ideas of hospitality is they would provide a woman, a shivcha or whatever, to keep a man company overnight. We find that at the end of Masech Avodah Zarah, we find that an Ovestid of Nosson in connection with Rabbi Akiva. So these Chachamim, Rav and Rav Nachman, didn't want to have to deal with that. They didn't want that the Persians are going to send them, or maybe even the local Jews have taken on that minhag, and they're going to send them somebody, and then they're going to have to send them away. So like this, l'chatchila, they announce that like this, everybody should know in town that they're married, and that way nobody's going to bother sending them that kind of unwanted gift. Anyway, so the Gemara asks, v'hatanya, now how could they do that? Now on the face of it, what we're saying is they're going to marry these women, they're going to have relations with them, and then when they're leaving town, then they're going to divorce them, and then they're going to go their way. The problem is, v'hatanya, don't we learn in a b'raisa? Rabbi Lozim and Yaakov Omer, lo yisa adam isha b'medina zu v'yelech v'yisa isha b'medina acheres. A man should not marry a wife in one country and then go and marry another wife in another country. Shemi is dab guzev zer etzel zer. You might have eventually the two families will meet up. A son that he has in one country might meet up with a daughter that he had in another country, and they don't know. They don't realize that they have a father in common. You can end up with a brother marrying a sister. You can end up with a father marrying his daughter. And the whole world is going to be filled with mamzeros, because after all, mamzeros is transmitted from generation to generation. As the pasuk says, the earth will be full with zima, which is with znus. Marsha says, in fact, that you have the beginning of that pasuk says, "Al techalalis bitchal haznoisa." Father has an iser not to allow his daughter to go out and be a zoina. And the point is, what happens? You have a zoina; she's with men. You don't end up knowing she has a child. You don't know who the father is. So that can cause, as the pasuk says, "Mala erz zima." So now, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is saying, even when there's not znus per se involved, but just marrying in different places without it being clear, is also going to cause the same kind of problem. So how could Rav and Rav Nachman do that? The answer is Amri. So the answer, Rabbanan kola islahu. The Chachamim are well known. When they have children, the children are known as the children of Rav or of Nachman or whoever. So therefore, there's no problem that they're not going to know, and they're going to end up marrying without realizing it, because wherever this person goes, they're going to be known as the son of Rav or the daughter of Rav Nachman or whatever. However, the Gemara says there's a different problem. V'amar Rava tavuhalina. Say Rava says that if a woman is propositioned for marriage, v'nispaisa, and she agrees to get married, tzricha leishav zayin nekiyim. She has to sit shiv nekiyim because we're concerned that once she agreed, there may have been what's called dam chimud. There may have been a tiny flow of blood that came from her uterus because of the chimud, because of the excitement that she's going to get married and she's going to have relations, and therefore she'd be tamei for her, and therefore she'd be tamei, and therefore midrabanan, she has to sit. Says she has to sit, wait for 7 clean days. So if they're first coming to town and then they're making arrangements to marry a certain woman, then what good does it do? They're going to have to wait 7 days. They're not necessarily staying in town 7 days. So the answer is Rabbanan Odua have a modulahu mikedem. Rabbanan Odua have a modulahu. The Chachamim would inform them in advance. It's not like when they first came to town, they would announce we're looking for somebody. They would make it known in advance that they're coming to town. They would go ahead of time and send a shliach when there was a particular woman who would agree to be Rav, or Rav Nachman's temporary wife. Then they would send a shliach to be Mekadosher, and then that way, by the time Rav or Rav Nachman come to town, the Shiva and Nakiyim have already passed, and she had a chance to toivel, and therefore there's no problem. The boy Sema, or another answer, you could say, it's not that they b'chlal didn't have relations with her, with them. Yichudi have a miyachdi. All they would do is do yichud with them. And so what good would that do? On the face of it, how does that help keep the Yetzirah in check? So that would answer the question about the children, because there won't be any children. That would also answer the question, Tosfos points out, that would answer the question about chimud, because in that case, there's no chimud. So what good would it do? After all, you can't compare somebody who has bread in his basket to somebody who doesn't. When a person knows that something is available to him, that itself weakens his taiva a little bit. So if they know that these women, that this woman is available to them, then that itself will help keep the Yetzirah at bay. Now, Tosfos actually deals with, at some length over here, so first of all, since when are you allowed to be in Yichud with somebody with somebody you're not married to? So what do you mean they're only doing Yichud? The fact is, if they wanted to do Bia, they would have to wait the 7 days, and we just said they don't have 7 days. Tosfos has a number of other questions on it. So Tosfos discusses at some length various possibilities. One is that miyachud have a miyachdilu, who may mean not that they were in yichud with them, but that they reserved them for them. They were saying, you're available anytime I should choose that I'm going to be Mekadosh you. So they don't actually necessarily go and be Mekadosh them. So that avoids the problem of children and the problem of Nidus, but they still have that option open to them. And that again helps keep the Yetzirah at bay. Tosfos also mentioned the possibility, maybe even it does mean they were Mekadosh them. They went through the Shiva Nakiyim. They're saying, we may choose to do Bia, we may not. We'll decide that as the time comes. You'll do the Shiva Nakiyim in advance, like the Gemara had said previously. As far as the problem with the children, we don't have to say that it's just the fact that the Chachamim are well known wherever they go, and therefore their children are known. The answer would be that if in fact they do become pregnant, then fine, he'll bring her back with him from Darshish to Sura, where he lives, or from Shransiv to Nahadah, where Rav Nachman lived, and that way there won't be any mix-up as far as the children and later generations. So Tosfos deals over here, and also briefly in Yevamos, with all the ins and outs of this Al-Pi Halacha. There is also discussion about this among Achronim. The Sefer Get Poshut brings up, which is a well-known Lomdash Sefer on the Halachas of Gittin, brings up the problem. Right after this, actually, this Gemara is also in Yevamos. Right after that, the Gemara brings up the point that a man is not allowed to marry a woman where he intends to divorce her. And here on the face of it, that's what they're planning to do. Now, according to one answer in Tosfos, maybe not. We're saying that if she becomes pregnant, then he won't divorce her. But still, if she doesn't become pregnant, then he will. Isn't that no sodom v'daita l'garsha? And different Achronim talk about different possible answers to this. There is actually a sicha in Chelek Lamed Daled where the Rebbe deals with this. You actually have this point that you're not allowed to marry a woman with intent to divorce her is actually found in two places in Shas. It's in Yevamos, in continuation with this piece over here, and also in Gittin. And the Gemara says it actually in two different ways and in the two different places. And the Rambam also brings it twice, Lahalacha. He brings it in Hilchos Yisurei Bia as well as in Hilchos Gerushin. So the Rebbe analyzes in some detail. The vort is there are two aspects of it, really. There's an aspect that you're not allowed to mislead a person. You can't have that he's going to marry her and she thinks it's going to be a normal marriage, and then he ends up divorcing her. There also, the definition of marriage is it should not be entered into with intent to divorce in the first place. So in this case, the Chachamim are informing them in advance, so that covers the first possibility, as that covers the first problem. As far as the second one, given that the whole purpose of this marriage is, as we're saying over here, to keep their tivus in check, or as Ben Yehoyada says, to tell people to make people in town realize how important it is to get married, so it's not really a marriage in the first place, and therefore you don't have that issue.
Isn't usually by itself a tremendous stumbling block for anybody? How do you know these rabbis are not going to just fall from the Yetzirah?
That's what we said. So that's why when we said Yichud, you have a miyachdilu. That's what I was saying. Tosfos deals with the question: what does it mean they can only do Yichud with them if they're not allowed to have relations with them? That's what I was just saying. Tosfos deals with that whole question at great length.
Is it flesh and blood?
Yeah, that's what we're saying.
How does he answer?
So he's supposed to answer. That's what I'm saying. One answer is that Yehud, it doesn't mean they would actually do Yehud with them. It means that they would reserve them. It means that they were saying, you're reserved in case I want to do Kiddushin with you, then you're going to be available for that. It doesn't mean they would do Yehud. And another answer is they would do Yehud. They had the option of doing Bia with the Shiva Nakim having been arranged beforehand. Anyway, the Rebbe ends up in that Sikha pointing out there's also a lesson from this in our relationship with Hashem. After all, we're compared to a husband, where Hashem and us are compared to husband and wife. And we know that Eberstein knew in advance there was going to be a golus, which is almost the equivalent of marrying a woman knowing that there's going to be a divorce. And how could Hashem do that? And of course, the answer is that Hashem has not actually divorced us. Eza Sefer Krusav Simchem, there's no actual divorce between Hashem and us. There's just a temporary separation. Okay. Going on, the Mishnah says, Masruhu Zikne based in the Zikne Corona. Now, during those few days, we said the Zikne based in, in the previous mission, I had said the Zikne based in had been busy rehearsing with him the Seder Havodah. They've been going over the Psukim in Achrimos and the Dinim and so forth. Now, the Zikne based in go and hand him over to the Zikne Kohuna, to the elders of the Kohenim, Vahilichu, Vahiluhu, Lishkas Beisavtinas. They brought him up to the second floor of Beisavtinas. The Gemara explains what he would do over there is he had to practice the Chafina Saktoris. Part of the Avodah on Yom Kippur, as the Gemara is going to explain later on in the Masechta, is the Kohen Gadol had to take a double handful of Torahs, put it in a spoon, in a large spoon, a large ladle, bring that into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Then he had to pour it from the ladle back into his hands and then sprinkle it onto the coals inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So that was a very hard thing to do, to be able to remember nobody can be with him in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So to get it from the ladle back into his cupped hands is a very difficult task. There's a few different ways that it talks about how he could do it. He could sort of manipulate the ladle with his fingertips gradually until he turns it over. He could put it between his elbows and rotate it. He could put it in his teeth and rotate it, whatever. It was a hard job. So therefore, they needed to practice it with him in Beis Avtinas, which is where they made the Ketores. They would practice it with him each of the 7 days before Yom Kippur. Then, Vihishbi'uhu, then also on Erev Yom Kippur, they would beswear him the Niftur of a Hocholahem, and then the Zikne Beisdin would leave because their job is now over. What was the beswearing? Va'omrim lo, they would tell him, Ishi Kohen Gadol, my master Kohen Gadol, Onu Shluchei Beisdin, we are the Shluchim of Beisdin, because we the Zkenim, are acting on behalf of the entire Sanhedrin. Va'ata Shlucheinu Shliach Beisdin, you are our Shliach, as well as you are Shliach the Beisdin. The Gemara describes, actually, the Gemara explains, Shlucheinu does not necessarily mean you are Shliach to do the Avodah. The Gemara, in fact, discusses here and in a few places in Shas, are the Kohenim fundamentally Shluchim of Hashem to do the Avodah, or are they our Shluchim? The point being, on the face of it, the Gemara says they can't be our Shluchim, because where do you ever find that somebody can't do something themselves and their Shliach can do it? The fact is, we can't bring the Korbanos ourselves, we being Yisraelim or Levim, only the Kohenim can do it for us. So if the Kohenim are our Shluchim, then it wouldn't work. There's no basis to say that they should be able to bring the Korbanos, therefore it must be the Shluchim of Hashem. So the Gemara explains, when we say over here, when they say to him, you are Shliach, the Ritva, HaKosev brings it over here from the Gemara, it doesn't mean, brings from the Ritva, that it doesn't mean that they're saying you are Shliach to do the Avodah, rather they mean you are Shliach in terms of taking the Shavua. In other words, don't think that you can take the Shavua and have whatever interpretation of it you have in mind. No, you have to be taking the Shavua based on our understanding of it. And so you are Shliach to take this Shavua, and you're the Shliach of the entire Beis Din to take this Shavua. Agav, in that connection, when the Gemara mentions this, when the Gemara discusses this point, whether the Kohenim are Shluchim of Hashem or Shluchim of ours, and the Gemara concludes they're Shluchim of Hashem, Tahani Shluchi Derachmona Ninhu is the expression. There's a well-known family of Kohenim who have the last name Kashdan, and that's where they get their last name. It's an acronym for Kani Shluchi Derachmona Ninhu. So they continue. Mashbiin onu alecha b'misha shikin shmoi b'bayis hazeh. We are beswearing you in the name of the one who made his shchina dwell in this house in the Beis Hamikdash, in the name of Hashem. In other words, shaloi tishana dover mikol mashar ma'un alach, that you will not alter anything of what we told you. Why? Because as the Gemara explains, there were tzdukim in the time of the second Beis Hamikdash, and the tzdukim, as the Gemara is going to say, They held wrongly a different way of how you're supposed to do the Avodah of the Torah. Given that the Kohen Gadol was alone there in the Kodesh HaKadoshim and nobody's there to watch him, they would have to swear him in advance that he's going to do what they told him and not do anything different. Why do they use the expression Sheshikin Shmoy Babayis Hazeh? Marsha says because the in the psukim there by the avodah that the Kohen Gadol does in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, you have the expression v'chein yasa la'oyom mod hashoichin itam b'soich tumoisam. Where later on in the Masechta, the Gemara explains from that pasuk we learn that everywhere where the Shekhinah rested in Shiloh and the Beis Hamikdash and so forth, you always have to do the avodah the same way. Therefore, they use this expression sheshikin shmoy b'bayis hazeh to echo that pasuk. Now, so the tzedukim again were doing things differently, as we're going to say in the Gemara. A couple of achronim deal with the interesting question: if the tzedukim held al pi Torah that you're supposed, if they held according to their corrupt understanding that you're supposed to do it the way they thought, then what good would it do to be swear him that he shouldn't do differently? That would be what's called nishba levatalos hamitzvah. The same way a person makes a shavua, I'm not going to wear tefillin or I'm not going to eat matzah on Pesach or whatever. It's not chal. So if the tzedukim thinks that the right way is to do the way that tzedukim do, what good is it going to do to be swearing to the contrary? He'll just go and say, Nishba levatal is a mitzvah. So Achronim give a number of different answers to it. One interesting answer, the Chassam Sofer gives, that concept that Nishba levatal is a mitzvah doesn't work as part of Torah Shabbat Peh. Well, the tzedukim don't believe in Torah Shabbat Peh. Therefore, as far as they're concerned, that would be a valid shvua, and therefore they would have to take it seriously. And there are other answers as well. Anyway. So continues the Mishnah, who Purdish Uvoicha, after they beswore him, he would go off to the side and cry, because as the Gemara is going to say, because they suspected him falsely, because maybe he's not a tzaddiki. And then he felt bad that they were having to suspect him. In fact, a couple of the Acharonim say he felt bad that things have gotten so bad that there could be tzaddikim in the first place in the Kohen Gadol that they should even have to do this. The Haim Poshin of Oichin, they would also go off to the side and cry, that as the Gemara is going to say, that they have to suspect him for nothing. They were Choshin B'Ksherim. Well, continues the Mishnah, Im hayachacham. Now, we said before that they had to keep him up the entire night of Yom Kippur. So again, because if he falls asleep, he could become a Baal Keri. So, Im hu hayachacham, if the Kohen Gadol himself is a chacham, dorish, then he would darshin in matters of halacha that whole night. The Im lav, and if he doesn't know how to learn, Tamar chachamim dorish from the fun of, then Tamar chachamim would give a drasha in front of him. The Im rogel likros, if he knows well how to read Tanakh, keep in mind, Tanakh then didn't have Nakud. There was no Nakudis, there was no Turup. You had to know everything about Peh. So if he knows how to do that, Koda, then he would read the Psukim. Bim Lav, Koda Lafonov. If not, then they would read Psukim in front of him. Over Meh Koda Lafonov, what would they read in front of him? Be Eob, or Be Ezra, or Be Divra Yom. All of those, it actually explains, those are all very interesting, fascinating Sfarim. So those would hold his attention, and that way he's less likely to fall asleep. Marsha says, you know, Eov is a sad sefer. We see you're allowed to learn an Tisha B'Av. However, though, first of all, it is fascinating. The debates between Eov and his friends are very, very fascinating and very, very gripping. But also, Marsha says, another point is that it is the one of the themes of Sefer Eov is what is a person's purpose in this world? Yavin Brachas, the Gemara says, when the mayor would finish learning Sefer Eov, he would say, Sof Adam Lomos, the end of a person is going to die. Ashrei Misha Amoleh B'Torah, happy as a person who spent his life working hard in Torah. So therefore, that's the theme of Sefer Eov. So that's an appropriate thing for Yom Kippur night to put the Kohen Gadol in a frame of mind for Tshuva. Anyway, so they would read him these books, or he would read them himself because they're very interesting. Tiferes Yisrael makes an interesting point. He says, so you have Sfarim that arouse your emotions. That would be more like Ezra, which tells about the difficulties that the Jewish people had building the second Beis Hamikdash. So that would tug on his emotions. You have Sfarim of philosophy. That would be like Eov, where it's interesting reading back and forth the various viewpoints that Eov and his friends and all had. And then you have Parshat people are interested in hearing stories, history, which is Divrei Hayamim. So therefore, that's why those Sfarim. Zachariah ben Kvotel Oimer. Now, Zachariah ben Kvotel, who was a Kohen who lived at the end of the second Beis Hamikdash, he says, "Pa'amim harbe karisa l'fanav b'Daniel." Many times I read to the Kohen Gadol from Sefer Daniel. So, in other words, he's saying it doesn't dafka have to be Eov, Ezra, or Divrei Hayamim. You could also read Daniel. You could maybe also read other books of Nachal. So, whatever happens to be interesting. So the Gemara says, "Who Purdish Avoicha?" Now, why was he going off to the side and crying? Shachashdu b'tzduki, because of the fact that they suspected him of being a tzduki, that they had to beswear him to do exactly as they told him.
Who's going off the side?
The Kohen Gadol. Yeah. the Hain Poshen of Ochen and the Zikne Beistin would be sworn him. They also went off and cried, the Amar Mar, the Amar Ishlokish, or Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Kolach, Choshed B'Kshedim, Loika B'Gufay. Anybody who suspects a good person unjustly ends up getting struck by his own body, as we find Rashi says that by Moshe Rabbeinu, he says about the Jewish people, Behein Lo Yaminu Li, they won't believe me, and Hashem puts Saras on his hand. So therefore, like, they were crying over the potential. Now, they had to be swearing, so it's not like they're doing it just stand because they don't like him, but still, they were crying over the fact that they had to do such a thing which normally would earn them a punishment. V'chol kach lama, now why do they have to go to such an extreme of beswearing him? Because they want to make sure he doesn't prepare the ketores, he doesn't put the ketores on the coals outside the Kodesh HaKadoshim and then bring it inside the way that tzedukim do. The halacha is, the Gemara explains later in the Masechta, now like this, you have the Pasuk says ki be'onon eroi ala kapodas. Hashem says you can't just go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim whenever you want because I appear in a cloud over the kapodas. The tzedukim understood that to mean that it means the cloud has to already be present when you go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Therefore, they said that it means you have to prepare, they have to put it on the coals so it starts smoking before you go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and by the time you go in, you already have a cloud of kapodas. The Chachamim explain that's not how it is. And in fact, in later Psukim, it says clearly, V'nosanas HaKtodesh HaLa'ej Lifnei Hashem, that you should put the Ketodesh on the fire before Hashem, meaning in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So now they were teaching him that's how he has to do it. He goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim with the ladle of Ketodesh and the pan full of coal, and only in there does he start spreading the Ketodesh on the coal. But because the Tzedukim misunderstood that, is why they had to beswear him not to do that. Now, what was this big deal? Why were the Tzedukim so hot to do it their way? And why were the Chachamim and Taka, why does the Torah insist that it should be the other way around? So Rav Shamshon Ofer Hirsch explains on the Psukim, he says the Tzedukim, later on, the Gemara explains when it discusses the basis for the Tzedukim's opinion and how the Chachamim refuted them, is they argued that it's not Derech Eretz Dik. When you're serving a king, you don't go start preparing the food in front of him. You prepare the food in the kitchen, and then you bring it in ready-made. The same way, so to speak, the Tertus, which is like the food that you're bringing to Hashem, needs to be prepared outside and then brought in ready-made. So he explains, in other words, that they took the view and when it comes to serving Hashem, you have to do things up itam l'das. You have to do things up seichel. You have to do things according to what's accepted by society. And therefore, even if that contradicts a pasuk, it doesn't matter. But the Chachamim are telling them that's not how Torah works. You don't modify Torah to suit what society thinks. There's a sicha where the Rebbe refers to something that Tzemach Tzedek explains on this. Al pi chassidus. The idea being that preparing the Torah outside would represent when can you do avodas habirurim, when can you work on refining the world, only when you're outside, only when you're in the outside world, when you're in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, when you're completely in the place of Kedusha, then you have no business with that. Don't be involved with the world at all. Whereas the Chacham, that was the Tzedukim's view. Whereas the Chacham are saying, no, even inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim, you may be on the highest personal level, you're still obligated to go work with the world and be mevarer it, which is represented by pouring the ketores on the coals. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Maisa b'tzduki echad shetikin b'chutz v'hichnes l'pnim. It happened once, there was a tzduki, Kohen Gadol, who did that. He put the ketores on the coals outside the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and then he brought it into the Kodesh HaKadoshim already burning. When he came out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he was very happy that he thought he figured he had fulfilled the mitzvah the way the tzduki say to do it. Pogaboy Oviv, his father met up with him. Omele, he says, Bni, afapisha tzdukin anu, even though we are tzdukim, and yes, we hold that what we're doing is correct, misyadun anu mina prushim, we're afraid of the prushim. Why are they afraid of the prushim? Because the prushim, meaning the chachamim, because we find that the prushim, the chachamim, most of the people, even the amei ha'aretz, were on their side. The tzedukim were only a tiny minority. They had a lot more influence than their numbers because they were rich and powerful and influential with the government. But in terms of actual numbers, they were very small. And even the amei ha'aretz and the poshut yidden mostly supported the chachamim, as we find different examples of it throughout Shas. Josephus mentions it in his histories as well. So this father is telling the son, you should know, we're afraid of the Prushim. If they find out what we did, you're going to be in trouble, so you shouldn't have done that. Omaloi, but the son says, no, my whole life I was concerned about this pasuk where it says, Kiba onani roa la kapodis, where Hashem says, I will appear in a cloud on the kapodis, where again, Tzedukin misunderstood that to mean the cloud of the kapodis. Really, it means the cloud of the Shekhinah, that is always present in the Kodesh Kodashim. So, Omauti, I'm always saying to myself, when am I going to have a chance to fulfill what it says in this pasuk the way that we tzedukim understand it? Now you're telling me that when I have the opportunity to do it, I shouldn't do it out of the fear of the Purushim? So in other words, it's like almost like he's having a mesiras nefesh of a corrupt kind. You have the same expression, you must say yovel yodiv akameni, we find Rabbi Akiva with mesiras nefesh. So here this guy is using the same expression, but in a corrupt way. Omru, so they said, what happened to this guy? Loi ho yo yom mu'otim ad shemes, not very long past before he died. V'huto ba'ashba, his body was lying in the garbage heap. V'yitoloim yotzis mechotmoi, and worms were crawling out of his nose. Why his nose? So Rashi says, because when you go into a place first, your nose is the first one of your evorim that goes in. Jews have big noses, you have the stereotype. So now Mephoshim point out on the face of it, maybe not. I mean, isn't he holding, he's holding the pan of coals. Isn't that going in first? But maybe it means like the first complete limb of his body. But whatever, we find Rashi refers to, there are other places in Shas where it talks about that a person might go into a place and his nose is the first thing to go in. Or if he goes in backwards, his nose is the last thing to go in. So therefore, that's how Rashi explains why he was punished after with his nose. The Ritva brings a different point and says because his nose smelled the aroma of the Ketores burning on the coals where it wasn't supposed to, outside the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So therefore he was punished with his nose.
Don't the legs go in first before anything?
So that's part of the question also, right. So yeah. Anyway. The Yesh Omer B'tziose Nigaf. Others say that no, he was struck when he first came out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Toni Dabchir came in Kol Nishma Ba'azara. They heard a loud noise in the Azara. Shabom Malach B'chovte Alponov. A Malach came and struck him on the face, or Alponov could also mean he struck him down, so he landed on his face. The Nichnas, or Echva Koyanim, the Koyanim came in to find out what's going on. Umotsu Kekaf Regal Ego Ben Ksefav. They found an imprint of a calf's foot on his back between his shoulders. And that was a malach that had come and kicked him. Shenema, as we find by the Chayes HaKodesh, that Yechezkel describes them, V'raglehem rego yishora, their legs are straight legs because they don't sit down. Malachim never sit or anything. So therefore, like, they don't have any joints in their legs. Their legs are also like one straight leg, which is why we put our feet together by Shemana Esrei and by Kedusha to evoke that. V'chaf raglehem, chaf regel egel, and the soles of their feet look like the sole of a calf's foot with a hoof on it. So now they found a hoof mark like that on this guy's back, representing that a malach had kicked him and trampled him. By the way, the Gemara mentions elsewhere that the Chayes HaKodesh cover those feet of theirs with their wings, because otherwise the calf regal eagle would evoke the cheta eagle, and they don't want that, so therefore they cover them with their wings so it's not seen. But here the malach exposed it and kicked this guy in the shoulders. Now Marsha points out the Yerushalmi asks question, we know that not only is nobody allowed to, actually Tosfos asks the question, we know that not only is no human being allowed to be in the Heichel when the Kohen is in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, even Malachim are not allowed to be in there. So how is a Malach going and kicking him? So Tosfos gives an answer that because when the Avodah is being done properly, then the Malachim aren't there. But here the whole point was this guy did the Avodah the wrong way, therefore the Malachim could stay in there. Marshal says that's a bit of a doichak. Marshal says no. What it is very simple. We're saying he was struck after he left the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Well, once he left the Kodesh HaKadoshim, there's no problem for the Malachim to come back in and for one of them to kick him. Ben Yehoyada points out, I mean, how do you have a machlokas b'metzius, whether he was struck, whether he died sometime later, or whether he was struck down and b'pashtus killed at the time? So he says it was both. First, he was struck down by the malach, but not killed, but that caused him to develop some kind of disease, like some kind of contagious disease, plague or something. Eventually, when his family realized how bad it is and that he's contagious, they sent him outside the city, and that's how his body eventually wound up in the garbage heap. Because he said, why would his body be in the garbage heap? Why wouldn't they bury him normally? Because they were afraid of the disease. So it was both, he says. Okay. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach V'Oma. Yud Ches Cheshvin. So we started talking about yesterday about how it is with eating and drinking in Osid Lovi. So we said in Yemos Mashiach, there's no question, there's regular eating and drinking. Then you have in Gan Eden. Now, Gan Eden is where you have Neshamas without bodies. So then, of course, there's no eating and drinking over there because that's only relevant to bodies. Then you have an Olam HaTchiyah. You have the world after Tchiyas HaMeisim. Well, then you're going to have Neshamas in bodies. And now Chazal say, so there's no eating and no drinking of Nis and that. So therefore, they're talking about the ultimate level in Schar. So therefore, that must refer to Olam HaTchiyah. So there will be Neshamas in bodies, but they won't need to eat and drink. Instead, there'll be Nen in Meziv HaShchina. The Rambam famously holds, because of that, since it's impossible for a body to live without food and drink, he understands that eventually all the people that come alive at Tchias HaMesim are all going to die, and their Neshamas are going to be in Gan Eden forever, and then that's when we're saying they're not eating and drinking. The Ramban disagrees with that and says the Neshamas will always stay in the bodies, and Tertus Achsidus agrees with that. Okay. Beginning a new simen in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. The dinim of traveling on a boat before Shabbos. So first of all, you're not allowed to go on a boat, on a trip, specifically the Altadeva says, we mean in salt water, so like an ocean, we're not talking like a river boat or whatever, within 3 days before Shabbos, so from Wednesday and on. If it's for a Dvar Mitzvah, then you're allowed even Erev Shabbos. Now, the Altadeva continues, Yesh Omrim, that if you know the boat is going to travel on Shabbos as well, it would be also from Wednesday and on. On the other hand, if you have, it would be also for Wednesday, even though it's from Wednesday and on, even though it's for a Dvar Mitzvah. But if that would cause the Mitzvah, it's not going to happen, you can't easily find another boat, then Yesh Lahoko B'Shas HaPchah. What that means in terms of nowadays, when people take boats only for like cruises and vacations like that, there's not necessarily a Dvar Mitzvah involved. So then the pashtus, it would mean that you can't take one that leaves any time from Wednesday and on, but for practical halacha, yaskar rav.
Also very unsafe.
That's the point. In other words, the point is, because there's actually a machlokas why it is, what the reason behind this din. Is it because during the first days of the trip, there's more of a likelihood there might be some kind of danger and you might end up having to be mechallel Shabbos? Or is it just because it takes a couple of days to get your sea legs the first couple of days? You're seasick, and therefore you're going to be uncomfortable and bitzar on Shabbos, and you shouldn't do that.